Today is Monday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the president is optimistic about his upcoming meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un tomorrow in Singapore.
President Trump is going into this meeting with confidence, a positive attitude, and eagerness for real progress.
Plus, what do South Koreans think about the summit? The number of displaced Syrians continues to rise, and just where are scientists getting inspiration from to program robots? It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said that his historic summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore could work out very nicely as officials from both countries meet to narrow differences on how to end a nuclear standoff on the Korean Peninsula.
We've got a very interesting meeting in particular tomorrow, and I think it's going to work out very nicely.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo echoed the president's positive view of the summit and hopes Kim Jong-un supports change as well.
President Trump is going into this meeting with confidence, a positive attitude, and eagerness for real progress. He has made it clear that if Kim Jong-un denuclearizes, there is a brighter future for North Korea. Tomorrow, we will get our clearest indication to date of whether Chairman Kim Jong-un truly shares this vision.
On the eve of the summit, I spoke via Skype with VOA's Bill Gallo, who is in Singapore. I started our conversation by asking him for the latest after President Trump met with Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong.
Well, I'll tell you, since Donald Trump got here yesterday, he's said very little about the summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It's obviously a very closely watched summit, but Trump has really kept, I would say even uncharacteristically, tight-lipped about it. He has only really said he thinks it'll go very well, things like that. But, you know, in his statements today, he didn't say much. And neither did North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who exchanged pleasantries with the Singapore prime minister. But, you know, today he pretty much stayed in his hotel. And we don't know what else he did.
Secretary of State Pompeo also addressed reporters earlier today. What can you tell us about his statements?
He basically doubled down on U.S. demands, of course, that being the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, is how he put it. He was then asked to clarify whether or not the U.S. and North Korea saw denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula as the same thing. He didn't really actually, say anything to that point, which is, of course, one of the most important points there is.
Right.
But he did. Okay. But yeah, he also said that talks between lower level officials that continue today, and he said are still going on, were moving better and more rapidly than he had anticipated.
Right, because that's been the main point of contention, because some analysts have said that denuclearization to North Korea means withdrawal of U.S. troops, withdrawal of the U.S. nuclear umbrella, whereas from the United States' point of view, it's complete, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization. And are the two on the same page, or is that what this meeting is still going to address?
Right. I mean, that is literally the question, the big question here that we don't know the answer to. But I will say that Pompeo, when pushed on these types of questions during his press conference today, did say, look, we're just not going to answer these questions. We aren't going to do negotiations in the media. This will have to be solved between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the only two people who can make those kinds of decisions in their country.
Can you kind of walk us through what the timeline of events will be for tomorrow's meeting?
Yeah, so it's supposed to happen in the morning. This meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un is supposed to happen in the morning. They will have a one-on-one meeting, and then they will take a ceremonial walk. This is all according to senior U.S. officials. After that, then they will bring in other officials to those talks. How long this will last, what will be announced, what kind of access the media will have, will they have some kind of, joint statement? None of that is really clear at all. We don't know how this will go, but, one of the most anticipated international summits in decades is going to happen tomorrow, and I guess we'll find out.
Now, the summit is going to take place on Sentosa Island, which is a huge, huge tourist draw. What are Singaporeans and anyone else traveling to Singapore saying about that kind of restriction as the summit approaches?
I think Singaporeans that I've talked to are, somewhat frustrated at the traffic restrictions and things like that. But this is a big city, and I think they can find their way around some of the temporary traffic restrictions. And one of the funnier things about the way Singaporeans are handling this is it's sort of a lighthearted thing. There is a certain amount of this, which is a spectacle. I mean, this is Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, and they, you know, we have Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump impersonators in town. We have Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un hamburgers and cocktails and steaks and everything. You know, I mean, it's a real branding opportunity for a lot of these businesses. I've seen, you know, the media is getting Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un notebooks, water bottles, fans. There's a little bit of it that's a spectacle.
Bill Gallo is in Singapore joining us via Skype. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
While the summit between the United States and North Korea is in Singapore, there are also about 50 million people on the southern half of the Korean Peninsula intensely awaiting its outcome. From Seoul, VOA's Brian Pan reports that South Koreans are optimistic that President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will reach an agreement to end the North's threatening nuclear weapons program.
Many people in Seoul are hoping the U.S.-North Korea nuclear summit will improve the prospects for a lasting peace in the region, even if no definitive denuclearization deal is reached.
What we want is peace. I wish that the summit works out well so that peace comes to the Korean Peninsula.
Prior to the Singapore meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, there have been rallies in Seoul by groups urging the two leaders to end the U.S.-North Korea nuclear standoff with a peace treaty. Conservative groups have also held demonstrations to urge the U.S. not to compromise with the repressive Kim government that has broken past denuclearization promises. But public opinion polls show strong support for progressive South Korean President Moon Jae-in's diplomatic efforts to persuade the North Korean leader to agree to denuclearization talks. Kim's popularity in South Korea increased significantly after the inter-Korean summit in April, where he was seen by many as non-threatening and open to compromise.
Regarding Chairman Kim Jong-un, I used to have a negative impression of him, but after seeing him on TV at the last summit, my impression of him improved a lot.
Trump's favorability rating in South Korea has also improved in advance of the Singapore summit. Many in Seoul still worry that the U.S. and North Korea will not be able to resolve their differences, as Washington wants complete denuclearization before any sanctions relief, and Pyongyang wants concessions tied to each phase of the process. After temporarily pulling out of the summit earlier, Trump has said he is prepared to walk away if Kim is not committed to end his nuclear program.
I am concerned that the United States might cancel the U.S.-North Korea summit again.
But overall, people in Seoul expect the Singapore summit to produce a positive result that will lower the potential for military conflict and move the peace process forward. Ryan Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Here are some other top stories from around the globe. A suicide bomb attack has killed at least 12 people and wounded more than 30 others in the Afghan capital of Kabul. There are no immediate claims of responsibility. The United States government's completion this week of a sprawling de facto American embassy in Taipei signals a strong warming of relations between the two governments despite pressure from Beijing. The International Labor Organization reports 152 million children are victims of child labor, with nearly half forced to work in hazardous, unhealthy conditions that could result in death and injury. For expanded coverage of these stories and more, visit voanews.com or download our mobile application to take the stories with you. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says their roving laboratory, Curiosity, has found fresh evidence near the surface of the red planet that suggests Mars could have once supported ancient life. The rover also found evidence in the Mars atmosphere that could link into the space agency's search for current life on the planet. NASA says the new evidence for ancient Martian life includes concentrations of organic carbon the rover found in 3 billion-year-old sedimentary rocks. Curiosity is said to have also detected seasonal changes in the levels of the organic compound methane in the atmosphere. The space agency stresses that while these new findings are not necessarily proof of actual life itself, they may provide important insight for future missions that will continue to explore the Red Planet's surface and subsurface. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. allies are lashing out at U.S. President Donald Trump for his trade threats and attacks on Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau after the Group of Seven summit. Joining me on the phone is Senior Fellow for Global Economy and Development at the Brookings Institution, Joshua Meltzer. Now, to begin with, has there ever been a situation where one member of the G7 agreed to a joint communique and, well, then withdrew support for it?
No, I'm not aware of, you know, that particular sort of sequencing of events happening before the G7.
So what happens to the G7 moving forward, since there is this great disparity between how the United States is viewing trade and really how Europe and several other countries are viewing it?
I think what we're going to see is a difficult period between the United States and, you know, a lot of the G7 the other G6, you know, partners on trade issues. The EU has made clear that it's going to be retaliating against the tariffs that the United States is planning to implement, Canada and Mexico likewise, and that this will continue.
Right. So, I mean, we're seeing retaliatory trades from Canada, Mexico, the EU. China has its own retaliatory trade tariffs coming up as well. Are we on the brink of a global trade war?
We're at the beginning of a potentially wider set of trade restrictions, which could lead to a trade war. I mean, certainly, you know, these are targeted tariffs at the moment that the United States is implementing pursuant to the Section 232 report on imports of steel and aluminium. I think, you know, the other countries have responsibly, you know, retaliated sort of in proportion and in kind. The question, I think, will be whether this remains targeted and narrow, whether the U.S. in particular escalates the dispute.
So in today's global economy, where you do trade with multiple countries, what is the long-term effect of something like this?
Well, a number of, you know, close sort of looks at the impact of these tariffs on the United States economy have, you know, concluded that the cost in the United States, just both in terms of the overall economic growth rate and also jobs, is going to well and truly outweigh any of the potential benefits of the steel industry. The steel producing sector is very small, but the important thing is that steel is used, you know, throughout the economy. It's used in making cars, appliances, it's used in the mining sector. And so these tariffs have had the effect, of course, of raising the cost of this crucial import. So while we will see some small gains in the steel producing sector, we're going to see, you know, significantly offsetting losses in the rest of the economy. In fact, one estimate is that the job losses will be 14 times higher in the rest of the economy than there will be gains in the steel producing sector.
Joshua Meltzer is a senior fellow for global economy and development at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks.
A rescue ship with more than 600 migrants on board was drifting in international waters Monday as Italy's new interior minister doubled down on his decision to stop it from docking at an Italian port. Reuters' Scarlett Vitanovic has that story.
A rescue boat carrying more than 600 migrants is stranded in the Mediterranean after being refused entry to Italy's ports. New Interior Minister Matteo Salvini instead asked Malta to take the Aquarius in, but his request was brushed off. Malta says it has nothing to do with the rescue operation, which took place in international waters, opening the prospect of a diplomatic rift between the two European Union allies. The Aquarius, operated by European charity SOS Mediterranee, has 629 migrants on board after six different rescue operations off the coast of Libya. Salvini, the head of the far-right league, has accused such charities of acting as a, quote, taxi service. His move represents an opening gambit to make good on electoral promises regarding immigration. He campaigned on halting the flow of migrants into the country. More than 600,000 have reached Italy by boat from Africa in the past 5 years. Numbers have dropped dramatically in recent months, but rescues have increased in the last few days, presenting Salvini with his first test as minister. However, he doesn't hold authority over the ports, and it wasn't immediately clear if his line would hold. The mayor of Naples, who has repeatedly clashed with the league leader, said he would welcome in the humanitarian boat.
That was Reuters reporter Scarlett Vitanovic. Spain has offered to take in the ship after Italy and Malta refused to let it dock. This is International Edition.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpuga, a host of Reporters Roundtable. This week on Reporters Roundtable, a discussion of Ethiopia's changing political landscape. That's Reporters Roundtable this Thursday at 17:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs, such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations reports Syria remains the world's largest humanitarian crisis as killings, displacement, hunger, and illness threatens the lives of more than 13 million people dependent on international life-saving aid in the war-torn country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Between January and April, the United Nations reports nearly 1 million people have been newly displaced in Syria, making this the highest number of people forced to flee their homes in a short period of time since the war began 7 years ago. Since last year, the number of people in hard-to-reach and besieged areas has dropped from 4.5 million to 2 million. Nevertheless, the United Nations says delivering humanitarian aid remains difficult. It blames this on the ongoing conflict, as well as bureaucratic red tape and the refusal of the Syrian government to allow most UN convoys into these areas. UN Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria Crisis, Panos Mumsis, says the humanitarian operation is suffering from a huge funding shortage. He says only 27% of the $3.4 billion UN appeal has been received.
With the low level of funding, the high acute level of emergency, the massive displacement, including evacuations that have taken place, the humanitarian response on the ground is really at a breaking point. We are stretched to the maximum. We're literally from hand to mouth, emptying warehouses, working around the clock.
Mumsis says the United Nations is worried about a new escalation in fighting in the northern governorate of Idlib. Mumsis tells VOA 2.5 million civilians are living in Idlib under very harsh, congested conditions. He says there is no military solution to this explosive situation.
The fact that civilians have been displaced there for quite some time, there has to be a negotiated way forward. There has to be a peaceful solution that avoids the bloodshed we saw in other areas, a peaceful solution that avoids more displacement taking place because there is nowhere else to go.
Mumsa says the United Nations has drawn up contingency plans so humanitarian workers can respond quickly to the needs of the displaced should fighting intensify in Idlib. He says he hopes this will not be necessary. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Despite astonishing advances in robotics, today's machines often struggle to accomplish what insects do routinely. So robotics researchers are taking advantage of nature's billions of years of experience. They are learning from bees to build flying machines that can learn and navigate their environments. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Their brains may be tiny, but bees can do a lot more than today's drones, says Alex Dewar at the University of Sussex.
An individual forager is capable of going out and exploring her environment, learning her environment, and finding a patch of flowers and foraging and coming home again. and then she can go on to communicate this information to other individuals and so on.
Dewar says a drone with that kind of deep learning computing power would need a heavy battery.
If you put additional weight on it, it makes it much more difficult to control. You need, it requires more power and so on. So the idea behind the project is, can we learn something from honeybees in particular in terms of power-efficient strategies for carrying out autonomous behaviors?
The Brains on Board project is studying insect brains and insect behaviors to use as models for intelligent drones. For example, programmers could learn from the way bees map their surroundings, says University of Sussex biorobotics professor Andy Filippides.
They'll do big loops around their nest that will serve to help them learn the environment so they can get back on the very first time. So that's kind of the next stage, is to look at how we can use behaviors we give the robot to enable it to structure the information that's coming in so that it makes the world easier to learn and easier to navigate.
The project brings together biologists and experts in machine learning and robotics.
We're studying the bee at multiple scales. So we've got VR, virtual reality arena, where we can record what's going on in the neurons, a very low scale. We've also got the higher up scale, the radar experiments. So we've got behavior and neural recordings. And then we've got the modeling expertise to be able to put that together.
The team hopes to have a robot drone flying autonomously within a year. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Oh, that was pretty cool. One final note before I go. Back in 1770, Captain James Cook, commander of the British ship Endeavour, ran into the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia. Therefore, as some put it, he discovered it. That's going to do it for me today. Patrice Martin directed the program. John Dryden engineered the broadcast. But before I go, thank you for spending part of your day with us. If you haven't, please follow Voice of America on social media, where you find pictures, videos, stories, and more. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Organization of American States, or OAS, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged fellow members to do their part to strengthen the OAS to deal effectively with the challenges to our values. The primary role of the OAS is to support democracy and human rights in the Americas. There is no greater challenge today, noted Secretary Pompeo, than the dismantling of democracy and the heartbreaking humanitarian disaster in Venezuela. The United States stands steadfast in support of the Venezuelan people and their efforts to restore their democracy. Secretary Pompeo urged all OAS members to support in Venezuela a return to the constitutional order, free and fair elections with international observation, and the release of political prisoners. He further urged sending a strong message to Venezuela by doing what the Democratic Charter says and suspending Venezuela from the OAS. Suspension, said Mr. Pompeo, would show that the OAS backs up its words with action. In addition to suspension, Secretary Pompeo called on the international community to apply sustained pressure on the Maduro regime until it undertakes the actions necessary to return genuine democracy and provide Venezuelans desperately needed access to international humanitarian aid. In Cuba, said Secretary Pompeo, there is an expectation that change is inevitable and that it can't come quickly enough. Young Cubans are demanding educational opportunities free from political constraints or a totalitarian regime's repression, said Secretary Pompeo.
As democratic societies, we must support young people in Cuba and elsewhere in the hemisphere in their hopes for democratic change.
In Nicaragua, police and government-controlled thugs have killed over 120 people merely for peacefully protesting. The United States demands that the government of Daniel Ortega immediately cease the violence, respond to the Nicaraguan people's demands for credible democratic reform, respect human rights and fundamental freedoms, and hold accountable those responsible for violence. On June 7th, the Department of State announced visa restrictions for Nicaraguan persons responsible for human rights abuses or undermining democracy in Nicaragua. The U.S. calls on all OAS nations to take immediate steps regarding Venezuela for the good of the region and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.